Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this event, White Ignorance and the Struggle Against Gentrification in Halifax, Past and Present. My name is Max Haven. I'm one of the co-directors, along with Alex Kasnabich, who's trying to get the fans to work. He's gotten the fans to work. Excellent. Of the Radical Imagination Project, which is the host of tonight's event. I'd like to begin this event, as we begin all events we can, by acknowledging that we are on unsurrendered, unceded Mi'kmaq territory, and we would like to thank the Mi'kmaq people for allowing us to remain here and enjoy the fruits of this land and build a life upon it. And it's to the question of how we build a life upon this land that we are turning tonight. We are talking about difficult issues. We're talking about the histories of race and racism and the histories of gentrification, the questions of urban development, the questions of property, and the questions of dispossession of property in this city. Originally, when I talked to Ted about this event, when I was in Montreal visiting, we had thought it might be a small event for a few people who might be interested in the topic. And very quickly, once we advertised the event, we realized that it was going to be much, much more popular than that, which is a wonderful thing. It shows that there's a great deal of interest within our various communities in this city on this issue, this important and burning topic. But it is a topic that we know is very contentious. It raises concerns among many of us for a whole variety of different reasons. And because of that, we have a difficult time addressing it directly. So what we wanted to do tonight is create a forum where we could address the intersections of gentrification, urban displacement, race and racism, and the history and present of Halifax in a space that is conducive to debate, conducive to discussion, and hopefully also conducive to challenging power. We at the Radical Imagination Project are an academic research outfit that is explicitly dedicating to empowering, enlivening, and celebrating the capacities of communities to organize against the dominant systems of oppression and exploitation in this society. And it's in that spirit that we welcome you here tonight to take a hard and direct look at the ways that systemic, structural, and other forms of power are operating in our city and in our lives. The Radical Imagination Project was founded in 2010, and has this commitment to catalyzing the possibilities for us to imagine social problems, not in the conventional sense, not in the sense that's given to us by those at City Hall or those who are in power, but from the grassroots, from the bottom up. And we attempt to catalyze the ability for our different communities and our diverse communities to come together and build a place of strength to be able to address these systemic problems. Our next event, which I'll tell you about just briefly, is the book launch for Miles Howe's new book, Debriefing Elsa Bookduk, The Anatomy of a Struggle. That will be a week and a day from tonight on Thursday night, coming up at the Halifax Central Library. Many of you will be familiar with the great struggle at Elsa Bookduk a couple of years ago against hydraulic fracturing, led very courageously by Mi'kmaq land defenders and their Acadian and Anglophone allies as well. Miles is an independent journalist with the Halifax Media Co-op, and he will be launching his new book, which has been published by Fernwood Publishing, stalwart members of the social justice community here in Halifax and indeed across Canada. So that is Thursday evening, May 28th at 6:30 p.m. That is our next event. Many of you have joined us for film screenings at the Halifax Public Library at the New Central Branch and other events in the past, and we look forward to hosting you at future events or working with you to organize events in the future. You can find more information about the Radical Imagination Project at radicalimagination.org. So, tonight's event, we have a half-hour presentation from Ted Rutland, who I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute. We have three respondents who will speak to the concerns that are raised by his talk and their own work as community activists and as scholars. And we will finally, after that, have time for questions and answers and comments from the audience. We will try and get as many voices as possible, so after our speakers have spoken, I'll ask for comments, and we'll take five or six before turning it back over to the panel to respond. So with that said, I'm going to introduce our speaker and our panelists in a moment, but I would just close this sort of introduction before that by asking you to help us create the atmosphere of healthy debate and discussion and respect, which doesn't mean that we won't challenge prejudices. It doesn't mean that we won't challenge preconceptions. It doesn't mean that the discussion will be easy. It does mean, however, that we are all committed to struggling through these questions together and coming out the other side in the interests of social justice, racial justice, and a better community that works for everyone, not only the interests of those with money and property. So, Ted Rutland is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Planning, and Environment at Concordia University in Montreal, and a member of the anti-police brutality collective Groupe d'Action et de Défense contre les Abus Policiers, GADAP, and I apologize for my atrocious French pronunciation. His research focuses on the radical politics of urban planning, housing, and policing in Canadian cities. And following Ted, we have three panelists I'm very, very privileged to be able to introduce you to tonight. Dr. Ingrid Waldron is an assistant professor in the School of Nursing at Dalhousie University. She holds a PhD from the Sociology and Equity Studies and Education Department at the University of Toronto, a master's degree in intercultural education, race, ethnicity, and culture from the Institute of Education at the University of London in England, and a bachelor's degree in psychology from McGill University in Montreal. She's also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Waldron's scholarship focuses on the sociology of race and ethnicity, racism in psychiatry, the social determinants of health, and environmental racism. She recently completed a multi-stage research project on the impacts of gentrification and other social determinants of health and well-being in the African Nova Scotian community in the north end of Halifax. Following her, we have Elle Jones, a spoken word activist and a teacher. She's the two-time captain of the back-to-back national championship Halifax Slam team in 2007 and 2008. Elle has performed all over Canada, including at the 10th anniversary All-Star edition of When Sisters Speak in Toronto. Her poetry is particularly committed to political causes and social justice, and has worked extensively with organizations around Halifax, performing and presenting on issues of social change. She is dedicated to using poetry in prison outreach and youth engagement, and volunteers twice a week at Centerline Studio on the corner of Uniac and Gottigen. Elle is current artistic director of the Word is Bond Spoken Word Artists Collective and teaches at Dalhousie and Acadia Universities, and is indeed Halifax's poet laureate, a fact of which we're all extremely proud and grateful. Lynn Jones grew up in Truro, Nova Scotia, where from a young age she struggled against explicit racial segregation. As a university student, she was active against the Vietnam War. She worked in solidarity with struggles for self-determination elsewhere in the world and fought for programs that gave Black and Indigenous students access to post-secondary education. Later, she became active in her union, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, and went on to become the first woman of color to be vice president of the Canadian Labour Congress. Please join me in welcoming them all here and welcoming Ted up to give his presentation.
Thanks very much for all of you for coming out tonight. I don't think I've ever seen a larger crowd gathered in one place to talk about gentrification, and so that's really promising for what is possible tonight and I think in the future. I want to thank as well Max and the Radical Imagination Project for organizing this event, and especially to Elle, Ingrid, and Lynn for participating. I've learned a ton from your writing and activism over the years, and I think a large part of the goal of my own historical research is to try to support the work that you're already doing in a more active way in Halifax today. So my aim tonight is to speak both historically and politically. My aim is to chart a certain path through history that enables us to think about politics in the present, and particularly the politics of gentrification in the present. Sorry. No problem. Now, I don't think that history can tell us what to do concretely, but I think that it can help us to see what people have done in the past, to reflect on what people have done, and therefore to contribute something to the way that we think about what we might do in the present. My hope then is to say a few things about displacement, and something that looks a lot like gentrification in the past, and then pass it over to the discussants and to all of you to think about how what I've said can contribute to a discussion about what might be, how we might understand gentrification in the present, and how one might struggle against gentrification in the present. And so the politics of gentrification, of course, are all around us this evening, and we are sort of in some ways in the center of it. This event is taking place in the north end of Halifax amid an accelerating and increasingly ugly process of north end redevelopment, repopulation, and reimagination. We can see this process in social statistics, and so the price of a home in the North End, and I'm talking just between North and Cornwallis, that's the red line, came to exceed the average price of a home in the HRM sometime in the early 2000s, and that's an historical first. We can see this in new condominium developments, new cafes, new bars, especially along Agricola and Gottingen. And we can see this in a very tangible, everyday kind of way, in planning processes, in discussions of what this neighborhood is, what it could be, and what it means to be a community at this time. And all of this, I imagine, is very tangible and everyday for a lot of you. And so how many of you live in the North End? It's like two-thirds. How many of you feel like the neighborhood is gentrifying? That's almost everybody. How many people feel like they're involved in some way in fighting against gentrification? Some. How many feel like they might be implicated in gentrification? Yeah, also. We can do something about that. It's okay. So gentrification, as many of you know, typically refers to a class process in which a poor or working class population in an area is gradually replaced with a more privileged and or more wealthy population. And this process is usually said to have begun sometime in the 1960s when this very long process of middle-class suburbanization started to get rerouted. And so sometime in the 1960s, middle-class people continued to live in the suburbs, but some decided that they wanted to live in the inner city as well. And a lot of that meant middle-class people moving into neighborhoods that were either historically working class or neighborhoods that had become working class as a result of middle-class people moving out to the suburbs. And the effects of this are things like displacement, either direct or indirect, like people physically getting removed from their apartments or homes. Also people feeling like the neighborhood is no longer theirs and seeking other places to go. People facing a changing retail environment that maybe doesn't serve them anymore. People facing different kind of policing practices that may target different kinds of behavior that used to be tolerated in the neighborhood before. So there's a whole series of effects that are produced by this process of gentrification, and of course, it's only accelerated since the 1960s. Less important, though, than I think than these particular definitions is how this is lived and experienced by people who live in the neighborhood. And so it's less important to have a kind of technical definition of gentrification than to look and see about what people are concerned about in neighborhoods that we might say are undergoing gentrification. And here I think Ingrid's research is really essential here. And so if you haven't read the report, North End Matters, please do. It's really an exceptional report. And what you see in this report, she's going to talk about a lot, some of it later, but one of the things that I take from it is you see people from the North End, particularly Black and African Nova Scotian residents, talking about what the changes in the neighborhood mean for them. And one of the things people feel is that other people are claiming a neighborhood that used to belong to them, and that the neighborhood is changing in ways that has no connection to what they'd like to see in the neighborhood. They also feel vulnerable to some kind of displacement. They often express that in terms of being able to afford to stay. And I think if we talk about these two things, the claiming process and a displacement process, then we can see that what we call gentrification and what we say began in the 1960s is actually part of a longer continuum, a longer historical continuum in which there's been all kinds of reclaiming and displacement. And I think if we look at that, we might see we might be able to pull out some lessons that are relevant to today. And of course, in Halifax, there hasn't been a moment in its history when there hasn't been a claiming and a displacement process, at least since this area has been gone under the name Halifax. And so Edward Cornwallis is famous, or ought to be famous, for two documents. He's the famous founder of the city, arrives in 1749, on the one hand, a plan for the new city that he's going to found, and the second is a bounty for the scalps of Mi'kmaq people on whose territory this is. And that in that conflict over this effort to found this city, to make this plan a reality, and the people whose land this is, and were never consulted about this, resulted in a conflict, and bloody one, and a lot of death. And so when we're talking about displacement, claiming, and violence, that's the history of Halifax. And so we ought to think about that, I think, when we're thinking about gentrification in the present, as sort of a continuation of that, with differences, of course. And so what I want to try to do tonight is talk about three moments where there's been a process of displacement and a struggle against it. And I particularly want to look at what I'm calling white ignorance, which is a way that I want to talk about the way that some very well-meaning liberal or progressive white people have sought to contest displacement, but didn't quite do what we might want white have wanted them to do. And so I'll explain what that means as we go. And so the first moment is over 100 years ago, late 1800s, and in this period in Halifax, there was an increasing concern about poor neighborhoods. And the major concern, beginning in the middle of the 1800s, was about the kinds of disease, a contagious disease, that took root in these neighborhoods. And there was a sense, first of all, that poor people are getting ill by things like diphtheria, cholera, etc., that these kinds of disease are contagious, and so we ought to care about whether these people are getting sick, whether we actually care about the people or not. And that these disease outbreaks have some relationship to the places in which people live, like the physical environments in which they live. And so with these concerns, there begins to be a whole series of plans to demolish people's homes, to eliminate the source of disease by eliminating people's presence in the city. What's important, though, and so this is a map of, which you can barely see, but a map of diphtheria in 1890, and there's some red dots that you can faintly see, and they're concentrated in what we know now, what we call now the North End, as well as some parts of the older part of the South End near the docks, which were both very poor neighborhoods. What's important, I think, to pull out from this is that soon after all these people are talking about demolishing these neighborhoods for pretty self-interested kind of reasons, a progressive movement emerges. And this is actually the period where the term progressive gets used, and it refers to people who actually want to achieve some kind of social change, a positive social change that isn't revolutionary, but that has concerns about poverty, about how people are living, about working conditions, about what people are getting paid, about whether government is democratic, all these kinds of things. And what we find is that the progressives entered the fray, entered the politics of displacement that were emerging, but rather than stopping the displacement, they substituted a different kind of argument for it. And so what we find then is a lot of very well-meaning white progressives saying that, yes, we ought to, like, bulldoze people's homes. They didn't have bulldozers yet. Just squash their homes. And we ought to, like, displace them, not because we're only concerned that we might get sick, but because these people are living in bad housing conditions. And because we care about them, we ought to put them in better housing conditions. And that second part didn't always work out into the plans. And so this concern with people's housing conditions leads to a whole series of new organizations, a whole series of campaigns around quote-unquote slum housing. It led to, for example, a five-part expose of the slums in the Halifax Herald in 1906 that really brought the reading public's attention to how people were living. And so I want to talk briefly about what came to light in that five-part expose. And so the area that they focused on was an area that used to be called the Upper Streets. Has anyone heard of the Upper Streets? It's the area where Scotia Square is now, which was... So you know where this is going, basically. Birmingham, Jacob, all these kinds of streets, which was one of the sort of high-profile, low-income slums, right, in the early 1900s. And the composition of the neighborhood is almost entirely poor, of mixed ethnicities. Some people are African Nova Scotian, a lot of people are Irish, some people are from Cape Breton, some people are Acadian. But predominantly some kind of version of white. But the expose was particularly interested in the homes of black families who were called colored in this context. And so I'll read a brief passage from one of the articles in the Halifax Herald. The scene in the small room was not to be easily effaced from the mind. The place had the foul smell appertaining to rooms in which human beings have literally, quote-unquote, lived for weeks, and from which, during that time, all fresh air has been excluded. As you entered the door, you saw to the left, ranged into confusion and dirt, cooking utensils and two empty kettles on a little stove in which there was no fire. Everything appeared to have a composite varnish of dirt and grease, and on a miserable table, an oil lamp gave a feeble light. To the right were what appeared to be two beds, moved so close together as to be practically one, which is morally should not do that. In them lay three small children, including a baby, and just beyond them, so still as hardly appearing to breathe, and swathed in dirty woolen rags, lay a colored woman. She turned when conscious that a stranger had entered, and it developed then that there was another baby, 9 days old, living in the curve of her brown arm. And so this invasion of people's private lives was of course, well-intentioned in a certain vague sense. They were meant to bring attention to the conditions that people were living in and to mobilize some kind of public concern about this, some kind of public support for some change. These efforts eventually resulted in a 1905 plan to demolish what was then called the Upper Streets and build a set of model tenements in their place. And so this is what the model tenements were supposed to look like. They were based on a similar undertaking that had happened in Liverpool, England, in the 1880s. The plan would bulldoze 8 blocks of the downtown, this area called the Upper Streets, and build 550 well-designed housing units in their place, and so house around 1,500 people. It's unclear how many people from the neighborhood would have actually ended up in these new units, but the history of model tenements construction shows that probably something like half the people displaced ended up rehoused in these projects. The plan was never carried through for lack of money, but what was implemented was a whole series of smaller initiatives that aimed to eliminate bad housing conditions and uplift and moralize the city's poor. And so parks were created where poor and working class children could play under the supervision of middle class men and women, mostly women. A children's aid society was formed, which could take away the children of parents who seemed to be behaving badly. Parents could also be charged or imprisoned because of the bad behavior of their children in public. And the Board of Health finally ordered the destruction of a whole series of homes which were deemed to be in bad condition. So there's the Board of Health inspector improving housing conditions. And all of these efforts were resisted in various kinds of ways. And so working class and poor mothers refused to send their children to these supervised playgrounds, even though this is basically free childcare. And so we ought to, they understand something about what's going on there that perhaps the people who are organizing the childcare don't. An interesting thing happened where an exhibit was set up on Gottesgen Street to kind of instruct the poor and working class families, like how to keep their home nice, how to like maintain their lawns, how to basically be good middle class people without middle class incomes, and a group of black youth would hang out by the display and like throw pieces of cardboard at people when they walked by and looked at it, and they eventually like demolished the display. Particularly compelling to me is the mother of a family that appeared before the Board of Health in 1906. So the family was the Orton family. I don't know anything about them beyond these few records that I've come across. And it was Mrs. Orton, the mother of the family, who appeared before the Board of Health in 1906. And it was at this meeting that the future of her home, whether it was going to be allowed to exist or whether it was going to be demolished because it was like bad living conditions, was going to be decided. And so the board tells her, your living conditions are filthy, this is horrible. She says, I'm keeping them as clean as I can, and I can't get nicer living conditions in this city with the money that I make. This report on this Board of Health meeting also reveals that Mrs. Orton was basically taking care of her children by herself because her husband had put in jail because of the bad behavior of their children. The report also reveals that the windows of their home had been removed by the city due to a previous board decision about the bad condition of the home, which was meant to get them out of there, and so they have no windows in February in Halifax. And so we have it. This woman is making do without her husband, with no windows in January, all because some people want to improve her living conditions. And so, there are some very sinister people involved in these plots, but I think it's important to think about these people who think they're doing something useful, but have no idea what it would mean to do something useful. And so I think that their involvement in this struggle over displacement is really important. And so there was a pre-existing move to displace people based on quite self-interested, kind of nefarious kinds of desires. And then white progressives emerge and give a more palatable kind of argument for displacement. So they don't stop displacement, they provide a different argument for it, none of which considers what people who are in these living conditions and in these neighborhoods would actually want. And I think there we can note a particular kind of ignorance that comes from these people's social position as both middle class and white in a society structured by class and race. And I'll come back to that notion of ignorance, what I want to mean by that in a moment. The second moment that I want to talk about is the 1960s. And so everyone know what happened in the 1960s? Africville gets displaced in the 1960s. And so There's people here who know this history, obviously, tremendously better than I do. But if you don't know this history at all, it's really important that you do understand it. And there's an NFP documentary called Remember Africville that is free on the website. And if you're living in Halifax and don't know this history, I really urge you to take the 30 minutes to watch this documentary and then go further than that. But for those who don't know it, the basic history is that Africville was a community of 400 African Nova Scotian people at the northern edge of the Halifax Peninsula. It was founded in the mid-1800s, although some people had probably lived there prior to that. And then this city, central city, developed northward. There was a sort of taking of Africville land and eventually a series of plans to demolish the neighborhood entirely, expropriate the land, displace the residents. Some of those residents ended up in Mulgrave Park and Uniacke Square. Some of them didn't. And so Africville is clearly an essential story. And learning about this in my early 20s sort of eliminated a tiny bit of the naivety that I had about Canada and my place within it as a white person. But I've always got the sense from African Nova Scotian people that I've met in Halifax that Africville was important because of the people who were affected and because of the place. But it was also important because of that it symbolized something bigger, something broader, and sort of a broader history of mistreatment, institutional racism, and displacement. And so a lot of my research is trying to come to grips with that something broader. And so I won't speak too much about Africville, but actually try to think about what else was happening in that time. And so part of this broader thing, it seems to me, becomes clear when we notice that Africville was one amongst a whole series of communities that were targeted for displacement and that were displaced in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The first community to go was this area that used to be called the Upper Streets and where Scotia Square is now. And so between 1958 and 1961, between 1,600 and 2,000 people, mostly poor, mostly white, but some African Nova Scotian people are pushed out of this neighborhood. A lot of them are supposed to get public housing units, but the public housing doesn't get opened until 3 years after a lot of them were displaced, and so people just get scattered. A lot of people were never offered public housing units to begin with. So there's somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000 people. In 1959, the city expanded this project both south and north, and so eliminated an area around Maitland, an area in the sort of older part of the south end, and displaced another 300 people. Another neighborhood that suffered displacement is the neighborhood just east of here, between north and Cornwallis, east of Gottingen. And so this area, and which includes where Uniacke Square was now, which used to be housing, which is still housing, but it used to be another form of housing. And so in 1961, there was a plan hatched to demolish all of this area and build a massive sort of commercial, retail, middle-class housing and public housing complex along the whole area. It would have displaced 3,500 people if the plan had gone to fruition. It didn't. So probably only somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 2,500 people were displaced between 1961 and 1980. In addition to these two plans, the city maintained a program of targeted demolitions beginning in 1958, and so targeting houses anywhere in the city that fell below the housing code, and that resulted in around 600 people being displaced. And so in total, we're talking about 5,000 people displaced in Halifax in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, in addition to the people displaced from Africville. Some of these people get new public housing, many of them don't, many are scattered. Of this sort of population, how many are African Nova Scotian? We have no precise figures, but the city is specifically targeting neighborhoods where African Nova Scotians are predominant. They're not the majority in a lot of these neighborhoods, but this is the sort of Halifax home of the African Nova Scotian communities. Africville, North End, et cetera. And so we're talking at least 600 African Nova Scotian people displaced, probably double that, maybe even triple. And so all of this is for sure classist in the sense that these people are poor, working class people who are getting displaced. But I think there are a whole bunch of ways in which it's racist too. And there are some people who say that, you know, it's because what's common amongst all of this is that people are like poor and don't have a lot of political power. We should really say that it's that and it's not racist, but I think we have to insist on and think about why this is also racist. And one of many ways in which we can highlight the racism of these actions is to look at these white liberals or white progressives who once again come into the debate about displacement and give it a different flavor. And so next to there's all these people who want the land, who want to make profit, who want to create a particular image of the city that doesn't include poor people living in the kinds of housing that they're living in. There's also a desire to like control people, to keep them under supervision in public housing. All kinds of like sinister and horrible kinds of intentions. Alongside those people, there's a few people who think that they can do something good through this plan. And their argument becomes very familiar. It's the same one as in the early 1900s, which is that people are living in deplorable housing conditions, we need to offer something better, and we're going to do that even though they don't want to move, necessarily, right? And so what this thinking ignored is that black people in Upperville and in the North End were largely homeowners. And that homeownership provided ways of surviving in a racist society. So less important to like navigate a racist rental housing market because you own your home. Less important to navigate a racist labor market because you don't have to pay rents. You don't need as much money. And there's all kinds of forms of subsistence, like gardening, keeping animals, etc., that allow you to survive in a racist society. And so what I want to say is that this elimination of poor people's homes and putting them in public housing might have created some benefit for white, poor, and working class people, although many of them contested this. So even that is a little bit too charitable. But when we're talking about poor and working class black people in Halifax, this process is quasi-genocidal. It's like removing their ability to sustain themselves physically, emotionally, and community, and placing them in a situation where they have to pay rent, where they won't be able to have access to like gardening, raising animals, etc. And so like eliminates their ability to like survive in the system. And so one of the reasons that these 1950s, 1960s, 1970s processes of displacement are racist, even though they don't only affect African Nova Scotian people, is that you've got a few of these kind of progressive and liberal white people who are trying to help. But the only way that they can try to imagine helping is actually imagining helping white people. They're imagining like poor working class renters getting better rental housing. They actually aren't caring or listening or paying attention to what actually is going on in black communities and what, if anything, might be desired in terms of urban planning. So they could have listened. And so we've got a whole bunch of people who are in addition to the nefarious evil people, who are trying to be helpful but have no clue what it means to help, even though they're facing like people telling them that they don't want to move, right? And so here's where I want to introduce this idea of white ignorance. And I would say that between a set of perspectives, say the perspectives of Africville residents who are saying like we don't want your plan, and these a collection of liberal and progressive white people who think that they know what's best, is a kind of ignorance. And so this term comes from the work of an African-American philosopher named Charles Mills, where he's describing a kind of ignorance that's not biological. He's not saying white people are biologically stupid, but a kind of socially produced ignorance. And so it's an ignorance that emerges from a social structure in which there's a whole set of walls, obstacles, and violences that people of color face that white people don't face. And so because they don't face it, they don't necessarily understand it, and they don't integrate it into their understanding of the way the world works. So basically, white people, it sounds paradoxical, but don't necessarily understand racism, even though they're the ones perpetuating it. And they don't necessarily take account for the effects that racism has on people's lives when they're thinking about how the world works, how the society works, and how their experience of the world, while we're constantly told that like our experience is like everyone's experience, that everyone experiences the world the same way, and that our experience is just like the truth, we don't recognize the ways in which that's actually a very particular experience. To walk through the world without experiencing racism is like particular. Some people go through the world like that, not everyone. And so what that means is, white people in a social structure organized around racism and white supremacy have this kind of huge blind spot, huge kind of ignorance in their perspective on the world. And so it's actually a very particular way of understanding the world, even though we're told that we understand everything. And it's a very particular kind of experience in the world, even though we're constantly told that our experience is just the experience, like the neighborhood is just the neighborhood, poverty is just poverty, etc. And we can always say, of course, we can always retort and say, well, everyone's experience is particular, and everyone's kind of like segregated into their own little perspective on the world. And maybe there's some truth to that. But what Mills says, and what people like James Baldwin have said, and what lots of people that I know have said, is that to be a person of color in a racist society means you kind of have to understand white people. You have to understand, like, their ideas, because they're everywhere in the public space. They're in advertisements, they're in discussions, they're in the newspaper. And you have to understand how they behave, because they're going to create obstacles for you. And so while it's very possible for white people to go through the world without ever really understanding the lives of people of color, it's actually very seldom the case that people of color don't understand anything about white people. And so it's a kind of ignorance that's socially produced. It's a kind of ignorance that is a kind of racism. It's part of racism. It's part of what maintains a society. And one of its products is creating these people who think that their experience is everyone's experience, think they know what to do, but actually don't really know a lot. This can be reduced, this ignorance, but it's there, and we got to recognize it. And that, so this, I think, we can see in the progressives in the early 1900s. I think we can see it in some of the progressives in the 1960s, and I want to say that we can see it in the last example that I want to point to as well. And so the very last example, which I have to go through very briefly, emerged in the late 1960s, and so not amid all the struggle over urban renewal. And it was actually the first struggle on a large scale to kind of stop a plan that would have displaced a large number of people. And so the plan in question was the plan to create this highway along the east part of the peninsula. It's in dotted lines along the bottom called Harbor Drive North. And this plan would have had all kinds of negative effects. It would have displaced 80 to 100 families in the old North End. It would have demolished a bunch of heritage buildings in the downtown. It would have destroyed a children's playground near UNIX Square. And there are a whole bunch of reasons in which people contested it. It was contested, and ultimately successfully, by a coalition of groups, which was a coalition that eventually included about 40 local activist groups, included groups like Heritage Trust, Ecology Action Center, etc. And they mounted a campaign in the fall of 1971 to contest this plan. In 1972, they were successful. The city abandoned the plan and obviously hasn't built that plan since. And I think it's a good thing that they won for obvious reasons. But there's something that I want to worry about in the way that they frame their opposition. And it's less about opposing it due to the displacement of these families, which is super important, the wrecking of this playground, but the particular kind of vision of urban space that they put forward in their opposition to this plan. And so one of the arguments that they made was that this expressway would destroy the kind of experience that existed in the downtown and that could exist to an even greater extent in the future. And that was experience that was described as the existence of this like lively, vibrant downtown, or a place to live, work, and enjoy ourselves on a 24-hour basis. And the reason I want to worry a little bit about that, and it's not a huge criticism of the activists, it's actually just a kind of worrying that I think we can do more in hindsight, is that that kind of idea of a lively, vibrant space or a place to live, work, and enjoy ourselves, this is the first example in Halifax of that vision. Previously to that, for 100 years, there's been a war on public space, a try to keep people out of public space. You can live and enjoy yourself in your private space. Do not be in public. And so this is like a huge moment in which we see a different way of being in public space. And it's exactly that idea that freights gentrification, right? And so the positive arguments for gentrification are a lot about creating a lively, dynamic, hip, authentic kind of place. And so I want to say that kind of idea that's freighting gentrification is emerging in this time. Why worry about that? I worry about that because I'm compelled by that idea. I want to live in a lively, vibrant kind of neighborhood. But I'm worrying about it more because if you look at what's going on in the downtown at that moment where people are describing it as a lively, vibrant place, it's that, first of all, we got rid of the downtown slum. And so 2,000 poor working class, some white, some racialized people are moved out of the downtown. If we look at the downtown at that time, groups like the Black United Front are saying that black people can't get a job downtown, can't rent an apartment downtown, can't get served in businesses downtown, can't basically get served outside of the North End itself. And so what appears to certain activists to be the space of like liveliness and vibrance is actually a space that a lot of people can't be in, that they're not in and that they can't be in. And so whose experience is this? Whose enjoyment is this? And what does it mean to suddenly say we want a downtown that's going to be lively and vibrant after these historical and present processes of pushing people out of it? And so I think in that vision, it's a particular kind of ignorance, which is that people don't people who are espousing this view don't recognize that what they experience as lively and vibrant is not everyone's experience. And that if we actually wanted to create a lively, vibrant neighbor, like downtown for everyone, we'd actually have to do particular things like tackle racial discrimination, think about like access to housing, etc. And that wasn't done. It could have been done, but it wasn't. And so coming into the present, I want to say that we've got these, I want to pull from these examples and say we've got three big examples of displacement, three examples in which there's all kinds of like nefarious, profit-driven, like dominatory kinds of reasons for displacing people. But in every moment, there's kind of progressive voice that comes and says, we want to do displacement differently in some ways. And I think in all of these cases, we can see the ways in which a socially produced form of ignorance makes it possible to believe that these things are good when, in fact, they're actually quite damaging to a lot of people. And so if we're thinking about gentrification in the present, then, there's a series of questions that I think we need to ask. What kinds of ideas are driving gentrification in the present? Whose experiences do these represent? If we say the neighborhood is improving, whose experience is that? For whom is the neighborhood not improving, either because it's getting visibly worse or because they're already gone? If we say that Gottesian Street is getting safer, for whom is it getting safer? If we say more progressively, and here's the harder thing, right? If we say more progressively that we're opposed to gentrification, who's coming up with this vision of anti-gentrification? Who's defining what gentrification means? Who decides what's important? What gets protected? What doesn't? Who decides? And basically what I'm saying is that what we can pull out of history is a sense that that if we don't think concretely about how racism works through these processes of displacement, then what we're liable to have is an anti-gentrification politics that's essentially a white politics, and that results in a whole bunch of racialized people, and I think particularly black people in this neighborhood, get displaced. How to avoid this, obviously, is to figure out where black people are struggling against displacement, who's organizing these kinds of struggles, and to prioritize these struggles, by which I mean not putting them alongside a whole bunch of other kinds of ideas, but actually making these the center, thinking about how to oppose gentrification by supporting black struggles against gentrification where those exist. And I think that to do that now, right, in a period where the black population in Halifax is on the descent, the only way in which an anti-gentrification politics is legitimate in this context, I think, is to prioritize the struggles of black communities against displacement. And so I'm arguing in the end for an anti-gentrification politics that prioritizes the experience, demands, and interests of black North Enders. What would this mean concretely? History can't tell us that, and I don't think that a white professor should be telling you that, ultimately. And so what I would like to do is conclude now. Thank you. And pass it over to other people who know better.
So I'm going to pull out a few things from research that I recently conducted in the North End, in the African Nova Scotian community in the North End. But I also wanted to contextualize this discussion by making connections between race, space, white privilege, and power as they pertain to gentrification in the North End. There are a few questions that I think are important to pose. First, what is the importance of neighborhood identity, community cohesiveness, neighborhood bonds, and sense of place for African Nova Scotians experiencing gentrification in the North End? And I'm pulling from Shireen Razak's book entitled Race, Space, and the Law, where she used a spatial theory to discuss the symbolic and material constitution of actual spaces and the relationship between identity, race, and space, posing several questions. First, what is being imagined or projected onto specific spaces and bodies? How much does an identity of dominance rely upon keeping racial others firmly in place? How are people kept in their place? How does place become race? The spatial approach offers the possibility of examining the simultaneous operation of multiple systems of domination, including race, class, and gender. Gentrification, like other systems of domination, such as employment and labor and environmental racism, is a racialization process that is directly experienced as spatial by those who feel displaced, as well as those who who are newcomers to a neighborhood, because it reaffirms existing racial hierarchies and consequently helps to sustain the social order. Entitlement to space, in this case the North End, which is the space we're discussing today, is a sign of personhood and legitimacy and is enacted both by those who feel displaced and those who are new to that space. Therefore, we need to denaturalize geographical spaces through critical interrogation of the role of law in producing and sustaining racial hierarchies of our white settler society. So one example is, of course, Africville, which was discussed. The eviction of one of Nova Scotia's oldest black communities from Africville is an example of how municipal land use regulations enabled white people to successfully dismantle a black community. So in research I recently conducted in the North End on African Nova Scotians that was completed early this year, I wanted to get a sense from African Nova Scotians about the sense of loss, the sentiments they had about the sense of loss that they defined symbolically and materially with respect to gentrification. And I just wanted to pull out a few quotes. One quote was already indicated by Ted, but a few quotes in terms of this sense of entitlement that African Nova Scotians feel to their place and to their space, and a sense of loss that happens simultaneously. You can look down the street and see people sitting out on patios and some really nice restaurants in the community, but you don't see us. You see us in that one area around the square. You see the kids walking back and forth to school. But it's almost like we don't own this community anymore, and other people are claiming it as their own. I'm in spaces where there aren't a lot of black people, and what I'm hearing up at Fred's place, up on the corner, and at Edna's, and at these other places, is our community, our community. I don't see one person in that room that looks anything like me. Mm-hmm. They're not from the community. They're claiming this community. We need to claim it too. According to another participant, housing is the main mechanism by which the pushing out of African Nova Scotians is enabled. It's not affordable. They're staying with the market rent. That's what they tell me. There's no non-profit housing. It's no longer non-profit. I think they're bringing all these condos and stuff in because they're really trying to push us out of this neighborhood. Like, we'll put this here, but they can't afford it. They won't be able to afford it. Other participants discussed the loss of various resources that were mainstays in the community. I don't like the fact that they're putting all these businesses, all these condos here. What happened to everything we used to have? Like, we lost our grocery store, our little place where we could go shopping, like our bank, like everything we had on the street is gone. We literally have to travel to get somewhere. As a community, we should have been able to keep that. So I also wanted to get a sense from the community members about their suggestions for how they can flourish in the North End amidst ongoing gentrification. And we wanted to kind of get a sense from them what their vision factors were. Vision factors are what you consider to be requirements for a healthy community. And because I work with a social determinants of health approach, it's not simply about illness and disease, but what is required in a particular community for health and well-being. And health and well-being is a broader term than health because it's not necessarily about disease, but about what keeps a particular community healthy. We know transportation does, access to recreation, access to green space, access to employment, access to so kind of symbolic ideologies about what makes you feel as if you belong to a particular neighborhood. So in asking community members about their vision of a healthy community, in a sense I'm asking them about their recommendations about gentrification, how we can address some of the issues that go alongside gentrification that could help support the community to flourish amidst gentrification. And of course the big one was housing and home ownership. They discussed increased home ownership in the African Nova Scotian community, decent and safe and affordable housing that spreads across the region, stabilizing existing renters, which could include assessing displacement rates, creating rent stabilization policies such as eviction controls and rent increase schedules, developing limited equity housing cooperatives and other forms of resident-controlled housing, which allows a neighborhood to stabilize by turning some of the high proportion of renters into homeowners. That's in housing. In terms of representation within the economic structure of the North End, they discussed more business opportunities, business ownership opportunities for African Nova Scotians, increased employment of African Nova Scotians in businesses and agencies in the area, including those of low income and those who reside in public housing, increased hiring of African Nova Scotians on the police force because of harassment, ongoing harassment in the community. When they discussed services and programs, they discussed asset mapping in the community to collect data on existing resources and services in order to determine which services are missing and which services are needed. More immediate services in the community, including food delivery services, affordable and subsidized ambulance services, taxi services, banks, bank machines, laundromats, grocery stores, health services, access to doctors within the community and dental clinics. More recreational programs, including programs for youth. We also discussed social interaction, creating a community-centered environment where all citizens can live, work, and coexist together, create more opportunities for community members to interact through the incorporation of transportation links, such as bike paths, and developing public spaces that attract all, creating opportunities for both those against gentrification and those who are for gentrification to come into social dialogue, just as we're doing today, so more of this, to hear different opinions, concerns, and needs related to gentrification. With respect to community capacity building and organizing, they discuss bringing together actors in community development, neighborhood associations, and urban planning to develop a proposal for a broad policy response to displacement in the community, creating sustained investment from the public sector and foundations to build local capacity to achieve equitable development, which may include engaging in locally relevant research. I've done that. It'd be great to use that. Using data and information to support policy change and inform campaigns. Crafting a campaign strategy. There was also a broad discussion on race, racism, and white ignorance. So just taking from Ted Rutland's discussion on white ignorance, I wanted to talk specifically about white privilege and racism, and anti-racism. So it's really important to acknowledge the role that race plays in the process of community revitalization, but also to acknowledge that race is experienced as a complex interplay of race, class, and culture. That means that all of us, but particularly white individuals, need to confront the racial hierarchies that structure our lives in various spaces. You also have to challenge the notion of law as raceless, as well as the amnesia that enables white subjects to be produced as entitled, rational, legitimate, innocent, and ignorant. Recognizing white ignorance as a symptom of white privilege is about understanding gentrification and other processes of racialization in general, including environmental racism, discrimination in employment, discrimination in the labor market, and everyday forms of discrimination. Central to this is an understanding of anti-racism, using an anti-racism lens to understand and articulate the symbolic and material realities of whiteness. Anti-racism is important to this discussion because it not only argues for the saliency of race for people of color, but it acknowledges that one cannot fully understand the social effects of race without appreciating how race intersects with other forms of difference, such as socioeconomic status, social class, poverty, gender identity, sexual orientation, and other social factors. Anti-racism examines the ways that racist policies and actions are manifested, entrenched, and unconsciously supported by institutional structures to consciously or unconsciously promote and sustain differential advantage or privilege for certain racial groups. It interrogates historically constituted relations of domination and subordination by questioning white male power and privilege. just to give some context to anti-race, to white privilege, it's about advantage, opportunity, benefit, a head start, or general protection from negative social mistreatment, which persons deemed white will typically enjoy, but with which others will generally not enjoy. And these benefits can be material, social, or psychological. In terms of material, it's recognizing that there are greater opportunities in the labor market, greater net worth, due to history in which whites have had the ability to accumulate wealth to a greater extent than people of color. In terms of the social benefits of white privilege, it's about the presumptions of competence, credit worthiness, law abidingness, and intelligence. The psychological benefits of white privilege, not having to worry about triggering negative stereotypes, rarely having to feel out of place, and not having to worry about racial profiling. The material, social, and psychological benefits of white privilege have much to do with the fact that whiteness is a culturally normative space where white or Euro-Western identity, ideologies, ways of knowing, and institutions collude in ways that sustain white privilege, power, and dominance within agencies, businesses, and public spaces. Therefore, we need to continue to question the naturalizing and normativity of whiteness within public spaces and institutions in the North End amidst ongoing gentrification. It is only when we begin to particularize whiteness in discussions on the mechanisms and processes through which gentrification unfolds will we begin to understand gentrification as a highly raced, gendered, and classed phenomenon.
Next, we have Lynn Jones.
Good evening, everyone. And I have to tell you, for the second time in 1 year, within a year, that I am totally blown away by an attendance at an event that deals with anti-racism. So congratulations to all of you. I hope I continue to be surprised, because it's a really, really great feeling. I can't thank the organizers enough for inviting me to be a part of this responding to our great speaker. And he reminded me, his face looked familiar when I came in here tonight, and he reminded me that I heard him speak when we were talking about the Black contribution to the War of 1812 event at the Black Cultural Center during the anniversary period. And after he had spoke, I had said, keep up the good work. So now I can say it once again, keep up the good work. You're on the right track, and it's really good. I have to tell you, I'm not one of these scholars that's doing all the research and whatever. I only know what I know about being on the streets. And I know about that. And it's good because all these different disciplines need to work together. Many a times, even still in doing my work, I wish I had people that could do some of the research that needs to go along with those of us who often are in the streets and doing the activism, that if we do it together, then we can change some of the things that we're trying to change. When they asked me to speak on this panel, I said, I don't know what I can possibly... Where's Max? What I can possibly contribute to this discussion. I can't even say the word. Every time I go to say it, I fumble it. It's like, degentra what? And so I would like to recommend for the scholars and academics, if you want grassroots participation, could you change the word? Then we might be able to understand it. So that's first. I got to talk about, too, walking in this room. I told them I'd only need a maximum 5 minutes because I have nothing prepared. I'm speaking from my heart. I wrote a couple of notes. But as everybody says something, I say, I can talk about that. I can talk about that. So I have to really limit myself. Don't be afraid to tell me to shut up. It's okay. It's not a problem. But when I come into this room and I see all you great people here, you must have a real interest and want to change for the good. I think you're all good people, right? I really do. I believe you must be good people. But you need to know how I feel also coming into this room. As I come into this room, I'm thinking, I don't know hardly anybody here. I'm in the North End. I'm here. I don't know these people. And I've been working in this community for almost 50 years. So, you know, but there you go. But it's not a bad thing. It's not, I'm not saying it because you're supposed to all come out of here feeling guilty because you're here. That's good. You're good people. You should feel good because you are here. But at the same time, you need to understand that the very things we're talking about in terms of displacement, disenfranchisement, segregation, all those issues, it's really happening right here too. So we haven't fixed it. And we've got to find some other ways if we're going to be talking about, can you give me a new word? Somebody give me a word besides
the takeover.
So we have to do that. I want to go back just a little bit to where I come from, which is Truro. I came to Halifax in 1972. Most of you weren't born then. And since I came here... No, you weren't born then. No, not at all. 1972, and have been working in the North End, agitating in the North End since I arrived. And I've never left. So I feel proud of that, I feel good about that, but at the same time I feel sad because I'm going to share with you a magazine article that I happened to dig out to figure out what I could talk about, possibly talk about. In Truro, I come from what we call a typical black community in Truro, the area, there's different areas. The area that I come from is the Marsh. There's three areas, Marsh Island and Hill. I was home yesterday, I spent the day yesterday in Truro. In our community, there's mostly black residents, poor whites, and Aboriginals. That's what I grew up with. When I went home yesterday, the family homestead still sits there, and I'm trying to figure out how many people were in that community as I was sitting there. Now, if I remember correctly, the Clykes up the street had 21 in their family. The Collinses had around 20. The Woodses, who had Aboriginal connection, they had around 12, 15, I don't know, kids. Across the street from us was the Halfkinneys. They had 9 children in that family. The Bordens, a little further up, they had 9 girls and 1 boy. This just gives you, you can add up all those people in that community. Well, when I went home yesterday, I think there are 3 families, 4, still left in that community. When I grew up, I can still remember us all playing together. And I remember fighting for sidewalks. There were no sidewalks. And the community members and the mothers and the fathers coming out asking for sidewalks. In my whole life and in my family's life, there was never a sidewalk. I left the community, I come back, most of the people I know are all gone. It is this takeover. There's now a sidewalk. And you know what? I hate that sidewalk. I really do, because when all those kids were on the street, there was no sidewalk. And to begin with, the roads were dirt roads. I'm also up there fighting on an issue of... The housing, the condos and things that are going in that little small community. And I come up from Halifax and go back there to work on that particular issue, as I do other community issues there. And I'm going around to the people that are scattered throughout the town and saying, come on, come, we got to go to town council, we got to fight this. They've got to adhere. We could create a historical community, black community, and bring people back. Because now they're renting, you talked about that. They used to own their homes, they're renting, they sold it to developers or practically gave it away. We can still do something, we can still save it. And people are saying, are you crazy? It's over. Like, you know, it's over. And no, maybe we'll get to move at one point in those new condos and what have you that they're building. Well, forget it. If you got the money to move in those and what have in the places where they used to live. I just share that because the issues aren't only happening here. They're happening all over. I also have, in this meeting, think about when I look at things, I always look at movies, different things in terms of subject and object, right? So, for example, I cannot stand, you could name a movie, and I'll go to a movie, and I'll hate the movie. And everybody will say, isn't that a great movie? It's about black people, how come you don't like it? And I'll say, because we weren't the subject of that film, we were the object of that film. So I kind of feel like that, too, when I'm here this evening. Because although I've worked and been here for a long time, I, in some ways, not necessarily to begin with the subject. I'm actually maybe, in many ways, the object. So it's really important, if we're going to hold for events like that, find the grassroots people in the community who have been here and what have you to speak at these events and share. So I just throw that out there. I want to talk about fear because you talked about fear. And I shared this at the film festival once. I get scared to death. I get scared now coming in on Gottigan Street. And I'm scared. I really am. Because when I used to walk Gottigan Street, it was the safest place in the city for me to go. And now, I don't see anybody that looks like me. I don't know, all due respect, I don't know what these white people are going to do to me. Especially if I'm out there alone and I don't have any protection or anybody that's alongside of me. It's a fear. It's a real fear. It's not the way it was. The infrastructure, you talked about the infrastructure in the community and how it's changed. Well, many years ago, too, many of the services and what have you that you had to go outside of the community, there was like a real divide. A lot of people hadn't even been gone down on Spring Garden Road. You were in the community. But then there were certain services that you had to go for outside of the community. So how, with this takeover, does the infrastructure of the community, change? But I want to share with you, because I said I would be 5 minutes. I now know that I shouldn't have given up my time. But you know, I do my devotionals. I mean, everybody has some way of finding their self and their grounding. For me, it's my devotionals. This one I'm doing right now that I've done quite a while is The Word for You Today, which is my daily devotionals. And, you know, it always seems like when I do it, it's just what I need. Like there's a higher power that's telling me what I need. And when they asked me to speak on gentrification, it's funny, it's amazing what devotional showed up for me in that time. I'd like to take a moment just to share with you the devotionals that came up and see. I was going to go through and make the connections for you, but I think, no, you're used to this topic. You know how to make connections. So I'm just going to tell you what it says, not the whole thing. But it says, in property law, as viewed by a toddler, Michael V. Hernandez described the world from a typical child's viewpoint. Number one, if I like it, it's mine. Number two, if it's in my hand, it's mine. Number three, if I can take it from you, it's mine. Number four, if I had it a little while ago, it's mine. Number five, if it's mine, it must never appear to be yours in any way. Number six, if I'm doing or building something, all the pieces are mine. Number seven, if it looks like mine, it's mine. Number eight, if I saw it first, it's mine. Number nine, if I can see it, it's mine. Number 10, if I think it's mine, it's mine. Unfortunately, it says maturity doesn't always come with age. Sometimes age comes alone. And unless somebody is important to your cause or your interest, they won't get your time or attention. Anybody make the connections? I love it. One last thing. I collect clip newspaper articles. It's the greatest thing in the world. It makes a mess. My house is always a mess. Always things all over the place. But newspaper clippings, I mean, I know it's the age where you can get things online and all of that, but there's nothing that beats the hard copy when you're digging through and something pulls out. Well, this here surfaced, and always things happen. It just surfaced for me. And it's says it's done in July, August, 92, and it's about taking back the neighborhood. Anybody see it? Remember it? No? It's about taking back the neighborhood. And Halifax North End resists a legacy of racism and poverty. Now, I was around at that time and know all of the people actually in the article, but I'll just read a little bit of this. The war zone is only the image most Canadians, including many Haligonians, see in their mind's eye when they picture Halifax's cottage and street. That's too bad. The reality is more complex, but far more interesting. And I'll skip. Goddington Street has been a predominantly black community for 150 years. Many of those who live here today are direct descendants of the first black immigrants to the province in the 18th century. During the 1960s, their numbers were swelled by displaced residents of Africville, a black community on the fringe of Halifax that was raised as part of a still controversial relocation. Although blacks now make up close to 5% of Halifax 113,600 residents, they are almost unseen outside of the North End. There are just five black policemen. Where'd our policeman go? He's gone. There are just five black policemen on a force of more than 250. For example, there's not a single black fireman in Halifax until the color bar was broken. Nova Scotia's racial disparities are nowhere clearer than on Goddington Street. A recent report for the Skid City School Board analyzed a census was a stark outline of this one small urban neighborhood. It only contains 13% of the city's total population, but 63% of its black citizens. And I'll stop there. I haven't got answers for you. If you had given me a little more time, I would have come up with those too. But thank you.
Good evening. Peace, everybody. Say peace to me. There's a Murphy's Law on phones, so the second I start talking, my phone's going to ring, and I will have to just answer it to tell him to call me back. It's a guy from prison that I'm waiting to call me, which is relevant to this discussion, because a lot of the guys from around here, from our communities, are obviously part of displacement, is people being displaced from their homes and communities, put into prisons and jails, and then separated from those communities, the burden on people to then support them, the burden on women particularly, you know, that now have to support people in these prisons and try and pay for their housing and be on assistance in a lot of cases and manage without the man in the house. So I will have to get this call, is my point. And there's a law about it, like the minute I start talking is exactly when the phone will go off, even though he had like 2 hours to call me. Okay, we've had a lot of like discussion, so I'm going to do some poems, and I also hope that people that live in this neighborhood will have a chance to speak and share their own experiences. But speaking of white ignorance, I guess I'm going to take that. Some of you may have heard this poem on racism in Canada. I actually wrote it when I went to the States. That whole thing of there's no black people in Canada. What do you mean there's racism in Canada? Isn't it just the Underground Railroad? So I was trying to explain white liberal racism in Canada, and I ended up doing it in a poem. So I'll share that with you, and then I'll do another poem, and then I think I'm good. All right. I gotta put my phone down. Canada is so polite. It's like someone bumps into us in the Tim Hortons line and we say sorry. We're always saying sorry. Well, I mean, not to the indigenous people for stealing their land. And Harper only kind of apologized for residential schools while crossing the fingers on his hand. And not to Angelique, who we hanged. And not to everyone we bombed in Afghanistan. And not for the internment of the Japanese or for the deaths on the railroad built by the Chinese. And not for breaking the treaties or racist immigration policies. But we're so polite. We always say please. Well, not to our migrant workers and imported nannies, but they should get down on their knees because Canada is the promised land. No, there was no slavery, just the Underground Railroad, because Canada is a safe haven. And forget about the ads for runaway slaves in the Halifax newspapers. Halifax is a gravy train for lazy immigrants who come here, and we just give you welfare earned by hardworking white taxpayers because Canada is so white. Just rosy-cheeked white people playing in the snow and the ice. Just snowshoeing and canoeing all day and night. And okay, those things were stolen from indigenous people too, but we invented hockey, right? Oh wait, it was black people who invented the slap shot and butterfly goaltending? Well, we hide that all out of sight. And that's why Canada is so quiet. Because everyone in Canada is so nice. And let's not mention the Shelburne race riots, or cross burnings, or Africville, or 1,200 missing and murdered indigenous women, but there's no genocide. Shh. It's rude to raise your voice in Canada. So let's just smile. Canadians aren't racist. We're peacekeepers. We're civilized. And Don Cherry's a national icon. But Canadians aren't violent or bigots. That's just hockey fights. Canadians are perky. No, there's no dirty secrets here. Canada is just quirky. Like we say Z and not Z. But if you talk about racism, we'll be like Z. There's no need for that here. Canada is never abusive. Canada is so inclusive. Canada is so inclusive, and the proof is that we let other people be here. It's like I just stole your land, and now I'm throwing a party, but you can stand at the back if you show us ID. It's like I just put you in the hospital, but here, let me start you an IV. It's like, what are you complaining for? You got 6 weeks of the Book of Negroes on TV. It's like we're gonna hoard all the toys, but we might just give you one if you ask us nicely. We could acknowledge you have things to offer us, but that's not likely. It's like P.K. Subban. We might let you be on the Olympic hockey team if you just stop being so black. I mean, so cocky. It's not about race. It's about character. We just don't want you to embarrass the country. It's just your attitude. We're not saying anything ugly. I mean, you should realize you're so lucky. It's not like America here. There's no history of segregation. That's why we wear Canadian flags in our backpacks when we travel abroad, because Canada has such a good reputation. I mean, we get to travel. You probably don't, but you just don't know how to teach English to those Asians or build houses in Africa, the country, of course, not the continent, because Canadians are helpful because Canada is so tolerant, which means we know your culture is worse than ours, but we let you do your primitive things anyway because Canada is so confident that we know better than you because our way of doing things is just dominant. We even let you wear your hijab. Unless it's Quebec. It's just unfortunate that your culture makes you so oppressed. It's not about racism, it's just about respect for our shared values. But we like your little costumes. They're so colorful. Because Canada is multicultural. We just wish that all you people of color could be more punctual. It's just that white culture is just more functional. But we just love diversity. And forget how the majority of the country votes conservative, it's just amazing that so many different cultures go to our child's nursery. But then we complain when you get an affirmative action bursary. Canada's multicultural as long as you put white people first. We like your food, fun, and fashion, but past that, isn't it kind of like racism in reverse? I mean, it's so unfair how black and native people get free university. We just want to make sure that everyone's worthy because Canada has so much courtesy. We speak English and French. Okay, not perfectly. All right, most people only know the French words for cereals, but let's not be absurd. This is still an English country, or haven't you heard there's no distinct societies in Canada? And that's why Canada is so bland. Nothing to see here, just miles upon miles of stolen indigenous land. Just fishermen and farmers and maple syrup, because that's Canada's brand. Just fields of wheat and outdoor ice rinks and all thy son's command. No, there's no guns and violence here, just socialist healthcare plans. And forget about the environment. Mental damage of the tar sands, because Canada is so grand, so good at perpetuating this international scam, so sincere at pretending there's no blood on our hands, because Canada's not like that. Canada's white as a lamb. And those other people, they're so angry. But true Canadians don't understand. So... that's my ode to racism and white privilege in Canada. All right, I'm going to do this poem, and then I think that's good enough. I might do another one, I don't know. I actually wrote this for the rally to save St. Pat's, which was like years ago, and people are still trying to save St. Pat's. So this would have been, God, in like 2010 or something, and there was rallies, and people were trying to get it, and the city had to go through this legal battle, there's like still going through the legal battle, which just kind of shows you the persistence in, you know, like it's just sad when you do a poem that you wrote years ago and you thought that maybe that thing would make a difference, and then you're, you know, 5 years later, and you can look at the poem, and in fact it's got worse, if anything. So this was actually written for one of the rallies that at the time when they were trying to prevent the sale, before they went through the legal stuff. We call ourselves Canada's ocean playground, but they will tear down the playground if you don't live downtown. If you are ground down in the north end, well, you will be considered to be down and out, and so the plans our communities write down are thrown out. In this city, we value children less than condos, where mono developers and head honchos get the ears of our government while the people are drowned out. We talk about development when what we mean is whatever gets us the quickest green in the short term, because true development is found inside youth programs and health clinics, and where minds and bodies are strengthened and lives are lengthened, in places where we meet and learn and grow, where we build with family and friendships and not bricks, and relationships are cemented between communities as diverse as rainbows. Here, the germ of unity is planted like in our gardens where our seeds are tended, and our roots extend through community centers named for our ancestors, places where we mentor our young on stories of Africville and the spirit that can't be killed as we see in them our elders' dreams fulfilled. And we educate and labor to build the skills of our youth, coming together over the grills of barbecues and on basketball courts as we lay the firm foundations that can't be bought for generations of children to rise up in this place we call the square. But we can't get there when we send our kids the message that their needs are too expensive when compared to the profits that can be collected from the rents. And so potential goes unspent. And the knowledge that descends from grandparents and parents is silenced when we treat our communities as expendable. We need excellence, but all we get is broken pledges, wedged into ever-narrowing blocks between the soup kitchens and meth clinics and needle exchanges that suburban communities campaign against having next door to them on the grounds that it's too dangerous for their children, while our children are pushed to the edges. Walking to kindergarten in the cold through miles of traffic on main roads because the schools in our communities are closed, when it's diagnosed as costing too much to keep them open after years of reducing enrollment created by threatening to close the schools in the first place. And parents struggle to keep them safe, but our proposals to elevate ourselves are ignored and then shelved, and we are told that we must be pretending or misled when we say, yes, this has to do with poverty and race. As if we can't notice the direction the city is going, and it's not our section of this map that they're growing. We live in these streets neglected, treating like uncollected garbage, our voices rejected, our children made targets with low expectations, regarded as hopeless, our schools, stores, and homes torn down to leave us defenseless, replaced by vacant lots and fences until one day we're selected, and our neighborhoods once thought worthless eyesores and slums become valuable real estate, and then no one protects us. We have been pushed out, dumped, relocated, cleared, gentrified, displaced, transferred, bulldozed, renewed, and erased into projects, housing, ghettos, low-income neighborhoods, shelters, blocks, strips, and the Ave more times than we can recollect, and we are still here keeping faith and paying taxes. And all we are asking is some space in our own neighborhoods for our children to be raised in. Because development is not measured in high-rises or ledgers. It's found in society where the poorest are treasured and where the elected find courage to fight to defend them. And where, when we build, we are building together. Thank you. All right, I'm going to leave space. Maybe at the end I'll do something else, but I really want the community members to have space to talk. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much to our panelists, and we will move now into the Q&A. I want to reserve the first section of the Q&A for community members who are on the front lines against gentrification, and after that we will open it up to the broader spectrum of the room. Yes, and you're welcome to come up and speak into the mic, or if you wish to protect.
Anyway, thank you very much. Ted, thank you very much for that talk. Lynn, you're absolutely right. That word has to be... We have to change the word. We have to have our own word to describe it, as Ted talked about. Genderfication, it's removal. By no other term, it's removal.
Yeah.
Now, us folks here, I'm from Africville. I was removed. I've lived all of my other time here. The thing I want to talk about is not just condos. I want to talk about when you look at our neighborhood in terms of the statistics surrounding our neighborhood. It is a low-income neighborhood that just happens to have the highest percentage of low-income housing than any other part of the city. Why is that? A healthy community, and Ingrid can attest to this, should be a community that is a blended community of incomes, types of housing, and different peoples. That's a healthy community. In our community, we went and had 6 houses built on Creighton Street for home ownership, so that those folks who had left the community would be able to come back to the community. Those 6 houses are on the space where 15 families used to live. All African Nova Scotian families used to live. So where's the advantage? And of the 6, only 2 of the home ownership is African Nova Scotian. When there were 15 families... So where's the advantage? But I really, really want to talk about is the intrusion into our community of low-income housing. Low-income housing should be shared throughout the city, down to South End, the West End, Clayton Park, the ravines, everywhere. We should be having low-income housing. I'm not against low-income housing because people need a hand up. But it's concentrated in our community. When we look at Gottingen Street, if we go back to the 1960s, I believe there was one service institution or agency on Gottingen Street. And if we look now, like Africville, all of the services not wanted in the other areas of the city area on Gottingen Street. Look at what happened when there was talk of putting a methadone clinic out in Fairview. You've seen the way that the community there rallied against that, not in our neighborhood. As a matter of fact, we don't want it so much, we're going to buy you a bus. And we'll give you a bus so you can drive around to the neighborhood, but you cannot establish yourself here. because it's sending the wrong message to our children. It's bringing the wrong people into our neighborhoods. This is a commercial area. We can't have that here. But we have it all on Gottingen Street. So for me, when we talk about environmental racism, this is all a part of environmental racism for me when I look at it in terms of the development of our community. Before, in the 1960s, people started dealing with the question of racism, we had our own, when we were denied entry, and not just on Gottingen Street, but throughout the city of Halifax, you weren't allowed. Signs used to be up, no dogs, no Jews, no blacks. Those are actual signs that were up in the city, throughout the city. But what that did, it made us self-sufficient in terms of providing services for our own community. We had our own stores, we had our own barbershops, because we couldn't get those services anywhere else. But in the struggle against racism, when we knocked down the doors, all of a sudden, that had a negative impact on the community, because people now could go to other barbers, so they no longer went to their community barber. And that barber, of course, had to make a living, so he could no longer make a living, nor she. So we lost those businesses, stores closed. The impact on the community, and we really got to look at the real impact on this community. It's not just from the replacement or the gentrification, but we also have to look at the other end of the spectrum in terms of what else is coming into our community. The development that's being planned for the corner of Prince William in Gottingen and Maitland, and on the old Met site. That thing was approved by City Council just because there was a low-income portion of that development, and that's why it was accepted. It exceeds all of the height restrictions on Gottingen Street. Gottingen Street, as an area and zoned, requires that the Gottingen Street level be commercial. But they've been given an exemption. They're going to be allowed to put low-income units on the Gottingen Street level.
One-bedroom, ain't they?
Pardon?
The one-bedroom, though, aren't they?
Well, there's the other thing. They're one- and two-bedroom units, and I believe there's some bachelor. So how does two-bedroom apartments really serve a family? A family of three, a family of four? It doesn't. So it's really not serving the need that they claim it to need. But I suggest that we take a look at the full spectrum of development in our area. And, you know, really, people need to be taking the task when we talk about economic development. You know, when black people are allowed economic development, they're going to become independent again as they once were. And maybe not have to worry so much about racism. But as long as we're dependent upon a system to provide us with an income, then we have to be very concerned about racism because it's going to affect our very lives and the way that we raise our families. So we really, really need to take a look at the root causes and start putting in programs that we can take a young man like Rodney here, just graduating Dalhousie University, and say, young man, we want you to run a business on Gottingen Street. That needs to happen, and that needs to happen. You know, and so I talk about that. I talk about those kinds of things that need to happen in our community. So it's a much, much bigger issue. And I think Ted went and addressed that when you were saying about that it's you can't just look at the surface. When you were talking about those neoliberal, you know, the dip. I've never seen that map around the dip theory of thing in 1890. Well, you know what else those neoliberals did in 1890 to address that situation? They built an infectious disease hospital right above Africville. And they moved all those folks out to Africville and ran a sewer down that emptied at the high water mark. So there was an open sewer in Africville. So at the same time that was going on, they built that hospital and a lot of other nasty things that they put out in Africville. But we really, really, You know, this community has always been a welcoming community for people. During the Dirty 30s, when the Depression was here, people of African descent throughout the province came to the Halifax area to look for work. And not finding welcome in any other area, found welcome in this community. You know, this community is probably the center of the gay community in Halifax. You know why that is? It's because the people are welcoming. They are welcoming. You're our neighbors. We love neighbors. We love to have people around. So we need to, when we're talking about these issues affecting the north end of Halifax, and be careful when you say the north end of Halifax too, because there's people on the other side of Yonge Street who will tell you, oh, you're not the north end, we're the north end. Just because the stigma attached to the area. And they don't want to be attached to that stigma. And so that's why they changed Goddington Street to Novalee Drive. One street, name got changed because of the real estate values. But you know what? Now they're shame. Because the real estate values here is much higher than the real estate values on Novalee Drive. So it didn't work. But we really, really... It worked in our favor. But we really, really, I mean, like if we're going to talk about issues in the community, we have to take a holistic approach to these issues. We have to understand the underlying causes and really deal with the root of the problem. Don't deal with the symptoms. Because we'll be dealing with the symptoms for our entire lives. We have to get to the root and cure it. Thank you.
Michael Davies Cole. I guess mine might be a little bit more angrier, what I'm going to say. I think it comes from... Excuse me, I'm just going to put my stuff down. Stuff, when I read stuff in the paper and they talk about our welcoming community, and we are. But when you come to the community and open a business or start something and say, I want to be part of your community, here I am, come in and buy stuff from me. And then get mad when we don't. And complain that we're not welcoming you in. And then we become the bad guys. That's a one-way street here. What are you giving us? You've moved into this area. You say you want to be welcoming and friendly. Invite me to supper. Buy me a beer. Don't get mad because I didn't shop in your store. Or I'm not part of this or part of that. You need to show me why you came to this community. Not just because it was cheap rent. And because it's a cool thing to do. Because it has become a trendy thing. We are not a phase. We were here before it became cool, and we've had to be here. Yeah. So if you want to be part of our community, that's fine, but recognize what you're being part of. Again, with the de-gentrification, when you come in and a lot of people say, I'm against this, I want to rally this, let's have this, let's start a cause, let's start a movement, let's do this. I sit on a lot of boards, I go see a lot of things, and I go to a lot of groups and a lot very well-meaning, but then the group is all white. So what are you actually working to include here if you've excluded right from the start? That's what you have to look at. And I'm not meaning to knock anybody that's doing part of and trying to do it, but as I think it's been said several times, take a step back and look and understand, because I don't expect you to understand what it is to be somebody of color. You're not, for those of you that aren't. Some of you are. Nor... can you expect me to understand, although I've had to live in your world a lot harder, and so I've had to learn very fast to survive, but I'm not white. I don't know what it is to walk into a room and not have somebody judge me. I don't know what it is to walk into some place and not have somebody assume something about me. And I don't know what it is to not stand in front of people and speak for my race instead of for myself. So those things you have to understand is, I don't expect you to understand what it is to be of color. Listen. You know, you can only see through your own eyes. For everything else, you need to listen, and listen well.
Thank My name is Benita Frazier, and I'm not a speaker, but I am a North Ender. I'm from a little black community, Lake Loon, Nova Scotia. My mother moved us into Halifax. I was about 8 years old. It was Creighton Street. Creighton Street was where the black people came, that came from the country, Digby, and we were a family. Creighton Street and Main Street. Then UniS Square was being built. My mother fought. We were the first family, actually, down UniS Square. Now I own a home in the North End on Main Street. I've been there for 17 years, and my community has completely changed. I, 17 years ago, could walk from Main Street down to UniS Square, down to Barrington Street to visit my friends anytime and not feel afraid. Now I do. Smith's Bakery, when I went to Johal, Bloomfield, and QEH, Smith's Bakery, we're always stopping there. Now I go in there sometimes. You know they don't want you in there. I said to my husband, this summer, we're going to make it a point to go to all your places. And I hope we're treated right. If not, I think my pockets will be full with lawsuits. You guys cannot come in our community, not give our children jobs. My daughter is a lawyer. She has to leave here to go all the way out to Alberta to get a job. But then you want to sit here and talk about the prison. All the black children who do have education have to leave here. Look at all you guys. You're all here. Your family's all happy. How come my only child can't be here with me? Yeah. Other people's children. You have to understand, and I've been, my mother took me to rallies. I took my daughter. And we have to stick together. Looking at all you guys' faces and not seeing our face, you get a hold of us through the church. It's been that way for 200-300 years. And Kowalla Street Baptist Church is just down the street, and some of you probably live right around there. And a lot of you, I see walking on the street. You don't even want to acknowledge us. You look at us like we're a piece of dirt or something. And I'm tired of it. So if you want to be welcome in our neighborhood and be safe in our neighborhood, you should be more kind and more inviting and give our children jobs. The summer is coming. Don't give them to your own children, your nieces and your nephews. And, you know, and I worked for the Water Commission for years. And so I know how it is here. I know how you get your own family, your own people. Stop doing that and let us in. We do want to work. We do own things, and it's because we're hard workers. We're not lazy, and half of us aren't on welfare, but I'll tell you that film tax, that's your white man's welfare check.
Other speakers.
Thank you. My name's Patty. I'm with the North End Business Association. And I just want to thank the organizers today for hosting this event and for this dialogue. I was asked recently, what are the examples in North America where gentrification has happened differently? And I was like, well, I don't know. There might be an example in Brooklyn. Apparently, there's an example in San Francisco. But there's not a lot. And the most common story is the story of displacement. And I'm standing here, and I certainly do not have any answers. I do not know what the answer is to gentrification is. But I do think we can try to do it differently. And I think it starts with these conversations, it starts with these relationships, and it's something that we're going to have to co-create together. So I'm representing some businesses that are interested in that. They are interested in hiring Where's the woman who just spoke? There you are. They are interested in finding, they're posting job opportunities. They're looking for members from the community to apply. This issue, as the keynote spoke, as Ted was saying, is much older than just what's happening right now. And I just hope that the community, in engaging with the businesses, they don't know how to do this. No, there aren't a lot of examples. Like, you know, there's not a textbook about how to do this. I don't know. But I hope we can engage in this conversation, figure out a better way, and not make this a classic story of gentrification. So, I'm available. If anyone wants to talk to me, connect with me, call me, please do that. I'm open to conversation, and I'm open to figuring something out. Thanks.
Oh, my name's Candace Day, and I want to speak about a community that hasn't been mentioned much today, and that's Creighton Street right here in Halifax. That was a very large indigenous black community. Most of us were homeowners. Most of us, most blacks that lived in Nova Scotia came from what we call and what we address as two lines. One line being down one end of Nova Scotia, another part from another end of Nova Scotia. But people, black people, always congregated on Creighton Street. And we had a very, like I say, a very large and a very close-knit and culturally strong community. And it bothers me and upsets me that the heart of Halifax, which is anybody from Creighton Street, that's what we called it, the heart of Halifax, has not been mentioned here tonight. And you need to recognize and know that we were here and that we have no intentions on going. And we're fighting back for our houses.
So my name's Neil. I used to, yeah. So I had the real pleasure of working with Candace, and that was the. I'll start with a bit about me. I grew up in a white affluent neighborhood in Dartmouth. My interactions with people of color at all. Really nervous. Most of my interactions were limited to bumping into each other in the hallway at school, and I was a very shy kid anyway, not to mention I had no idea of how to interact. I had no idea what I was doing. So I just did this, and it went pretty well. So I would say up until, and then even when I was in high school, I went to Dartmouth High, and Dartmouth High suffered from a very strange assisted separation, whereby you would pick your lockers and where they were, and there were hallways. And each hallway was essentially directly connected to a neighborhood. So I was hanging out with all of my friends from my neighborhood in my hallway. And as a result, even in a city, even in a school that had a very good ratio of people from every neighborhood sort of surrounding, we never really mingled. The classes were segregated as well. Just by nature of our interests and previous education, basically. So as a result, I had no idea. I still say that I have no idea what's going on. Working with Candace, actually, I'm really happy I got to follow her. Working with her, we had a very mundane task of sorting dead letters together. And the idle conversation that we had was the first glimpse that I had that there was such huge disparity, and I had no idea. Since then, I've moved into the North End, and I'm that guy that we're talking about. You know, and it's strange to be in that position because I Like, when I saw that this was called white ignorance, I was like, perfect. That is exactly what I feel like I'm suffering from. I have no idea what's going on. And I don't know even know where to begin. So, an interesting thing that I've noticed, I live on Willow, right at Clifton. I live across from the Newfoundland store. A lot of people from the neighborhood come to the Newfoundland store. It's a bit of a strange hub, and yet, everybody drives there. Nobody walks. I never see anybody walk up. I sit on the front porch playing guitar, and people will get out of their cars. They'll sort of smile at me, go into the store, come back out, get back in their car, and drive. And I've seen them on their stoops as I wander through their neighborhoods, and they're a stone's throw away. There's no reason not to walk, you'd think. But there is. And tonight I got the opportunity to hear some of the examples and how that feeling is. So, yeah, I guess I'm just saying that I have no idea. And that some of us are as lost as you guys are. And we'd love to help. I'm glad that this is happening, and I hope that this keeps happening and we keep coming out. Talk to each other.
Maybe a couple more comments before we turn it back over to our panel. We did post the end time for this event at 8, but we started late, so don't feel bad if you do need to leave and whatever.
Can I ask if there's any other indigenous people self-identified? Wonderful. It is so hard to be in a space where your voice is singular. I'd just like to begin by saying I appreciate the panel. Thank you so much, each of you. When we talk about inclusion, it kind of has to start at this level, where we have our keynote speaker as a Black or Indigenous person. We have to come face first into this group where we have people that are like, people that don't have that opportunity to have that space to talk. So as much as it's great to have respondents, I'm often welcomed into spaces to do a dance, to do a prayer, to do a ceremony, but I've never been asked to speak as a keynote in this community. It's also really important to acknowledge that there is no one way to fix this issue, and that it's so hard because we have so many like historical issues that are coming up, and we're coming up here because we don't have that space. So as soon as we come up here, we're like, this is it, you know, Africville, slavery, residential schools, everything. And it just like comes at you like all at once. But in actual fact, we can tackle these one by one. We can take these issues on one by one if we're allowed the space, if we're given the space to talk about it. So when we're up here and we have the opportunity to talk, it seems like this like tsunami of issues that come behind us, and it seems so powerful. So it starts at this level. That's my message. And it starts with talking to different people that I haven't seen. I know a few of you, but it starts just with kinship. It starts with approaching people in public, acknowledging, making eye contact, you know, just allowing that space where you're not like looked down upon. You know, so when we're looking around this room and there's like definitely POC people, definitely white people, we need the opportunity to like actually make contact. And this is your opportunity. If you don't leave this room without making contact with a POC person, then you shouldn't have been here. So I just want to, give that opportunity. My friend Tino is here. Do you want to say anything?
I guess.
Come on, Leah.
Just to address like the woman from the North End Business District. I think it's kind of.
Go to the mic.
I think it's kind of. I don't really know what the word to use would be. You were saying like people should come to you but you're coming to their community. They've been here, you know? So, like, this community center's, I had to leave because I was actually, like, physically, like, angered by that. Like, you're expecting these people that have been in this community to come to you. Mm-hmm. Like, that's entitlement.
It's privilege. It's entitlement.
And privilege, and it's, I'm shaking right now because I'm so mad. Mm-hmm. That's not okay at all.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tina. Yeah, so I guess that was my message, as well as to just acknowledge that I know people are sick of hearing it, but we are on Mi'kmaq unceded territory. Okay? I had a friend of mine whose partner recently said, I'm tired of going to events where I have to hear this. It's really too bad. You know? I'm a Ojibwe, Soto Ojibwe from Manitoba. I was born and raised in Toronto. There are like over 10, 13 treaties in the city of Toronto. There's not one singular treaty here in Halifax. So we have to remember that. We have to acknowledge that this is like, it's not a historical like museum type issue. That it's a very current issue. Mm-hmm. And that it's when we're given the space to speak at these events where we have the power to say, like, hey, okay, actually, yeah, let's, like, do a land claim. You know? But it's when I'm afraid, when Tino's afraid, when we're afraid to speak in these environments, that's when we just, like, swallow it.
Mm-hmm.
And I need everybody here, White and POC, to like support each other and to like, you know, be true in solidarity. It cannot be convenient solidarity anymore. Miigwech, ki kana gana.
Hi there. My name is Evan Cool. I'm a community legal worker with Dow Legal Aid, so I work in the neighborhood, but I've mostly lived in the West End and Dartmouth. It was a great event, and I just wanted to talk about three different issues that I'm working on right now that I think is relevant to some of the discussions that were happening tonight. For starters, how many people here work for minimum wage or close to it? Do you think it should be $15? So right now there's a coalition of unions, community organizations, and political organizations coming together to demand that the government raise the minimum wage to $15. It's absolutely ridiculous that people work full-time and still live in poverty. So this is a step to addressing that. For people who don't or can't work, through my work at the Dow Legal Aid Clinic and my work with Nova Scotia ACORN, we're putting together a general assembly of people who are on income assistance. This is happening Wednesday, May 27th at the JBO Center. It's at 2103 Godigan Street. Food and child care are being provided. We held a bunch of meetings throughout the city, different areas of the city, Dartmouth North, in this neighborhood, and in Spryfield. We identified three main issues. One is affordability. $535 a month is not enough to get you a house anywhere in the city. And $250 a month is not enough for food, transportation, clothing, laundry, what have you. Second is access to education and employment opportunities. For all of the stereotypes that exist about people on income assistance, the Department of Community Services actually makes it quite difficult for people to access education to make themselves more employable, and makes it difficult for them.
Did the minister get two university degrees?
That's right. Yeah, she did. She spent 9 years on income assistance in the 90s and is now, while she was getting her master's degree, and is now telling people that 4 years is an extraordinarily long time to spend on income assistance. So they're making it really difficult for people to access GEDs. GEDs, they'll tell someone to get a job or look for a job in fast food before getting a GED. They'll make someone jump through months of hoops to get into any education program, and that's not right. For employment and for the person from the North End Business Association, I know plenty of people from my work who are looking for jobs, and no one's hiring right now, mostly because of the color of their skin. So I would encourage you to do a little bit of outreach, maybe go to the YMCA Employment Center, maybe go to the UNIAC Center for Community Development. I'm sure there's plenty of talented young people who would be happy to work in North End businesses. However, Department of Community Services, they make it hard to work too. So that was another main issue. And then finally, for people who can't work, people who are disabled, which constitute 60% of people on income assistance, the government just makes it cruelly hard to access basic needs, basic health needs, medical equipment, special diets for people who are diabetic, bus passes. They're cutting bus passes. They don't even give you a bus pass or a phone if you're looking for work, so figure that one out. But so that is next Wednesday, May 27th, from 5 to 7. There's information about it on the Halifax Media Co-op's website, or you could call the Dow Legal Aid Clinic. I brought 5 flyers, so I might not have enough, but I'll leave some. Is there a place maybe on that table? I'll leave some on the table, so maybe if people want to copy down the information and leave them so other people can see them. There was just one more thing. I became aware through my work with Dow Legal Aid and Acorn last week that Metcap, have people heard of Metcap Living? Big-time slumlord, they're a national corporate landlord. They've started doing credit checks, and they've increased their rent to $680 a month for a one-bedroom apartment. DCS, if you're on assistance, the max you can access is $535 a month. And if you work minimum wage, even with full-time hours, that's about 50% of what you're taking home. So it's not quite gentrification. I learned the term upmarket. They are trying to kick, but I mean, as terrible as those apartments are in Highfield Park Pinecrest, as terrible condition they're in, like there's a beautiful community, but the actual, you know, places themselves aren't great. They were a place of last resort for a lot of people, including probably some people who were forced out of this neighborhood because of their financial situation. So I'm a member of Solidarity Halifax too. We put together a statement about that, and I brought more than 5. There might not still be enough, but I'll start circulating it. I'll put it on the table. And it will also be online tomorrow if you want to learn more about the situation. And thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this.
Our panelists have graciously suggested that they not follow up with comments and we just allow more voices from the room. What I would propose to you is that we continue to have people speak till maybe 8:30, which is in 10. Maybe we'll give it 10 or 15 minutes. And let's say 10 minutes till 8:30. And then I encourage everyone to stick around and get to know one another, because as we've heard tonight, this is an important part of building a sense of community and a sense of strength that would actually allow us to confront these issues.
I actually had more of a question for the panelists, so I thought it would be a really nice lead-in. But my name's Logan Lawrence. I'm a graduate student at Dalhousie University, and I'm clearly not a person of color. One time I was living in Mississauga for about 3 months on a school work term, and I got in a bus, and I was the only white person on the bus. And like that was the first time in my life that I'd ever experienced anything like what I can only imagine would be that a number of people experience here every day, where they feel that sense of otherness, where they look around and they don't see a face that isn't theirs. So I can't say I understand what that feels like, but from my limited experience, it was a pretty scary thing. So I'm sorry you guys have to go through that on a regular basis. I guess my big question, because I've been to, Elle's not here anymore. She was here, but She did an event at Dalhousie a few months ago on leadership, and we talked about you know, race and equality. And my big question for that was, you know, as a privileged white male, what's my role in this? And I know a few of you pointed out too, you know, there's a little bit of irony in the fact that our keynote was a white male, not to take away anything from, you know, the message that you had. So that was going to be my question to the panel, because I'd heard, you know, there's some things that you can lead and there are some things that you have no role in leading and you can do your best to support people. So that's my understanding of it, but I'm curious for what the panelists think the role of, you know, people who aren't people of color, people who come from a position of privilege, what their role is, in being a part of making change in our community. And I'm sure people in the audience have something to add to that too.
There was another question, yeah?
Hi, I wasn't really intending to come up. I didn't really know about this until about an hour before the event. I live just on the other side of that Yonge Street barrier in Hyderstone. I'm not from Halifax, I'm actually from Ontario, and I'm working a good job downtown. I'm a carpenter, and what I had noticed is that a lot of the black men, the only job, the well-paying jobs they can get in the construction industry are in concrete placement and finishing. It's a good job, I mean, in terms of pay. Long hours. A lot of these guys are working 12, 15, 16-hour shifts on their Fridays when there's work. So I wanted to say something about Halifax as well. I come from a pretty messed up conservative town of London, Ontario, and there's some good things going on. But my high school, Beale Secondary, across the street, there were two methadone clinics. Conveniently, there are times to come to those methadone clinics when we were in class, and it was a nice. The teachers would be like, "Oh, that's a reminder of what you can become if you don't finish school." This is also the most multicultural school, where a lot of the indigenous students would come in on a bus from outside of town. They were sent to that school because, well, there's a methadone clinic across the street, and that's acceptable. And also, conveniently, there was a multi-million-dollar police station put next door for that reason as well. One thing about Halifax, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia in general, is that while you talk about these issues a lot more than other places in the country, and I've lived across the country, there's a lot of action here, and it's really, really encouraging when you want to get something done, you want to change something, you can come and talk to people, whether it be the church or the YMCA or even the business associations. I've been involved with the Granary Food Co-op for the last 2 years. I think, I don't see anyone else that's of volunteers. In the last month or so, we've realized that we're all white. That hasn't always been the case as far as I understand, but we're wondering, well, why is it all white? It's not that we haven't said, oh, well, no blacks allowed, or it's not that we haven't reached out when volunteers have the time to reach out, but it's because, well, maybe we're not attracting people from other cultures because we're the only people coming up with ideas. Maybe we're only catering to our own. Now, we have set an initiative to reach out. Now, while we can't hire any of you because nobody gets paid at the Granary Food Co-op, we are always looking for volunteers, and it's a really great place for career development and learning and trying new skills, and it can be a stepping stone. So I kind of want to take this opportunity to reach out to you, welcome you into our doors, and we'll be doing a better job at reaching out to you as well. So, thank you.
Sorry, I'm acting a bit like a diva coming in from outside. You haven't seen me yet. My name is Tamar. I've been thinking a lot about this issue. I came at a good time when the people from the ground were speaking. And to my peers, who I see a lot of in my room, so you got a privilege, white skin privilege, wealth privilege. I think there's a very simple thing we could be doing, but I think what we're not willing to do is stick it out. And a campaign that would mean success is 5, 10, 20, 25 years. And I don't think we're willing as a group to stick that out. And that would be requiring betraying the people in our families, betraying the people that we depend on, and losing some of that privilege in that defense of other people, which include a constant degradation of yourself. There's no other way. If we're gonna stand with our brothers and sisters who are dealing with this all the time, what you think we're not gonna get to feel it? No, I'm sorry, we're gonna have to feel it. And I worked in city government for 2 years in Vancouver, and I could tell you the bureaucratic corruption is disgusting. And we don't know the bureaucrats' names. We don't know where they live. We don't know where they go and eat their dinner. We don't. And you know who does know their names and where they live and who pays for their dinner? Is people with money and the developers. And they're in a constant lobbying campaign. And we're not making trouble for anybody. And it's not a kind of trouble that takes 5 minutes. It's like, are you in it for the long haul? Because there's no way to win unless you're in it for the long haul. And we should not be putting people with less privilege on the front lines and having them have to deal with these people. It's us. Us. We have to be dealing with these people. We're the ones that have to go interrupt all of it and take the heat and be accountable to the people with less power and privilege. And if we're not willing to do that for a long time with no expectations from, I think the hatred towards white people is legitimate. Mm-hmm. Legitimate. I don't think it's effective, but I don't judge it. I don't judge it. It's fair. And people with less power, in whatever position you are, and people with less power, we don't get to expect the trust from people with less power. No, we have to prove our trust to them, and we only prove that stuff over a long period of time. And with the issue of gentrification, is we talk about single mothers, and they don't have time. So we have to check with them and see what they're saying, and be accountable to them, and they make the decisions, and we do the dirty work.
I've heard that some of our panelists do need to go, so I'm going to bring it to a close on that excellent note. Please join me in... Oh, yes.
I guess I shouldn't have waited, but actually this is an invitation, and I think perfect flow off of what Tamar is saying, that it is going to be a long time before we start to see some things, and it's actually just going to be a lot of work. And so I think... I've been working in this community for a little bit over a year. I'm from North Preston, and so I think that historically, you know, I hear stories about how my grandparents would talk about their parents, taking their horse and buggy on the street from North Preston over to set up their stuff to sell on Goddard Street, and then come back and bring that wealth to their families. And so for me, it's, you know, like, I feel like Goddard Street is my home, and that connection to Preston is so strong for me. And that actually, I found out that my great-grandparents, I'm still learning the history, but that we actually have some links to Africville. And so I'm finding out this information about my history every day. And so my dedication to this work and this community is really strong. And I want to invite everybody. I've been working on this project with the Barrister Society for over 6 or 7 months. And it's a really important piece of work, because what I did was I designed a process for the Barrister Society to... This is the first time that the Barrister Society... Not the first time that they've done engagement, but the first time that they hired a community consultant to come into their organization to help them craft a design, a project that... of engagement. So I did that, and so I'm really proud standing here to say that I worked with the Barrister Society over, 6 or 7 months, or probably longer, to create a community engagement plan that served the community. And there's an event happening Friday in which I would invite everybody to. I know that we, like, if everybody comes, we will be short of food and all that kind of stuff, but oh well, that we're going to have the Chief Justice there. We're going to have some deputy. There's going to be the deputy of whatever. There's some key players from the justice legal profession that are asking questions about what do we do. And so we really need to come and take them to task. It's going to be at the Friendship Center, Friday, 12 o'clock till 4. And we're really inviting you to come. We're going to share what the process that we've been that we've done over time, an engagement process. There's also going to be the report that I wrote in partnership with some people at the Bear Society. So that report of what I heard from people when I went out, asking them, what do we need to do when it comes to justice? And so there's some meat in that. And it's going to be, I mean, what I hope is, like, if we have a grid represent, and I can post this on the page so that everyone can kind of, like, I can post it. But I really want everyone to come, because I think that we really need to show up in numbers. We really need to kind of come with some ideas, and we need to hold people to task and show. If this room came and said, like, we care about this justice issue, which I think gentrification is one, a huge one, and we represent to them that we're ready, just in the mere numbers will kind of show them that we're taking this serious. And there's a question.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, are you aware of the conference going?
Yeah, so yeah, it is running. There's a lot of things that are going on this weekend, so it's really hard to pick a date sometimes, and so we hope that it would be. And I'm trying to just promote in any kind of way that I can, and hopefully that there will be another phase. So, I mean, I think whoever can come on Friday, that'd be great, but then there's a whole other phase that's going to come to the ground, so... just to kind of, and I guess, I mean, this is another question too. It's like, what is the best way of getting information out to people, I think, is one of the hard things. But I think that, you know, this is a role that the Radical Imagination Crew can play, and a role that, you know, NECC, the North End Changemaker, like Lisa Roberts, there's roles that people are playing to get information out to people. And so I think that whoever's playing those roles continue to do that, because we really need to kind of... get the invitation out to community in a way, and residents, you know, like, what's the best way to kind of, I mean, oh, it's through the Y and those other places, but maybe people come up to me and I'll take your number down and I'll call you personally. And that's all I have to say. Thanks.
And a brief announcement. We have one more brief announcement.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. I'm Anne Devine. I just want to say I'm sitting there and I'm feeling really quite guilty, because the person from the North End community, Patty, she's still here, okay? When we heard about the gentrification of Gotchardon Street on the radio, myself and Professor Mei Chung, we decided to take a walk down and see what we could do, what we could help. How we could participate, having done employment equity partnership when I was at the Human Rights Commission, and various diversity work. And through Professor Ingrid Waldron, I have to say that Patty did reach out to myself and Professor Mei Chung, and we will be meeting her on Monday. So I just want you to know that they have made an effort, and it would be totally wrong of me to sit and allow it to pass, that she didn't reach out to
Thank
us.
Thank you, Anne. That's true. She reached out to me and wanted to help. So I think we have to acknowledge that.
Thank you for that. Brothers and sisters, it's been a singular pleasure and great privilege to learn from all of the people in this room and to share this time with you. I am uncharacteristically optimistic about the future. And I hope you'll join me in celebrating that optimism by sticking around for a few minutes and meeting and greeting people you don't know, and forming those connections we know will be the bedrock of a successful struggle to reclaim our city from the forces of oppression and exploitation, as they affect all of us, but not all of us equally. So please join me in thanking our panelists, and join me in thanking others who've spoken tonight. Have a good evening.